Today on Vox Talks, how can Africa's economies recover from COVID? Welcome to Vox Talks from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. Africa's citizens have so far mostly been spared the direct health consequences of the COVID-19 pandemic, but its economies have still suffered. So how can firms, households, governments, and international organisations respond? That's the focus of a new e-book called Shaping Africa's Post-COVID Recovery, and it's launched by the CEPR this week. It brings together the insights of around 40 economists on subjects from debt to FDI to food security after the crisis. Simeon Jankoff of the Peterson Institute for International Economics and Ugo Panizza of the Graduate Institute, and of course, Ugo's a VP of the CEPR, are two of the editors, and they join me now. Welcome to Vox Talk, Simeon.
Hello, Tim.
And welcome back, Ugo.
Hi, Tim.
Now, Simeon, I'll start with you. Africa has not been hit as hard by COVID, as I said, as we maybe feared it would be a year ago. So why are the economic consequences of this pandemic so bad for the continent?
Well, Tim, Africa depends a lot on investment and trade from the rest of the world. And with so many restrictions, healthcare restrictions, as well as trade restrictions after COVID or during COVID, African economies have in fact been hurt very, very significantly, particularly economies that depend a lot on tourism. As you well know, a number of African economies are very dependent on international tourism, which has practically been stopped altogether.
And do we know which countries or people or sectors in Africa at the moment are hurting the worst?
In our book, we study this question and acknowledge that the economic troubles, the economic suffering at the moment is worst in the southern part of the continent, South Africa, Namibia, Botswana, but also in the western part around Senegal, Ivory Coast, and so on. This is, as I mentioned, a double hit for them. Tourism receipts, which used to be 10-15% of GDP, have vanished altogether. And trade, particularly trade with Europe, has also been shrunk very significantly.
Ugo, I did say that so far, Africa hasn't been hit by a large number of COVID-19 infections. That's not to say it won't happen in future. How big is the potential downside risk if, for example, a new variation of COVID starts spreading rapidly in the continent?
Yeah, this is really worrisome. As you know, there is this new variant, which is called 501V2, which was first discovered in South Africa. And now cases have been found not only in countries in the southern part of Africa, like Zambia and Botswana, but also in West Africa, in the Gambia. And this is worrisome because it means that this variant is spreading quickly throughout the continent. And this would have negative implications on both for Africa, but also globally. So as you mentioned, so far, Africa has recorded a relatively low number of cases. COVID had a very large impact on the economic side, but on the infection side was relatively low. But if to this very large economic impact in countries which are already characterized by high levels of poverty, we also have a surge of infections. That's going to be a real disaster. This also has global implications because if the vaccines that have been developed so far happen not to be effective or maybe less effective with these new variants, then the vaccination effort that we are trying to implement now in the advanced economy would be mitigated. And we'd risk to be in a situation and once we have vaccinated a lot of people get sick with new variants. So it's really important that we help with vaccination, not only in advanced economies, but also in poorer countries. And this is not only for, you know, ethical and moral issues, but it's pure self-interest because, you know, we don't want to go into some kind of vicious circle.
As I said, this book covers firms, households, governments, international organizations. Let's start with firms. Simeon, which firms in Africa have been hit the hardest and why have they been hit the hardest?
Well, Tim, some of the sectors and firms that are hit the hardest are similar between Africa and the rest of the world. So retail trade, because of restrictions, have been severely hampered. Tourism, the transport sector, because there were outright bans on travel between major cities and the rest of the country, in West Africa, in South Africa, in parts of East Africa. So that has been very difficult. But perhaps more so than in Europe and advanced economies is the trading sector. Because one of the severe consequences of COVID is that customs offices closed for a number of weeks in many of the African countries. Airports closed, ports closed, and some of them are still closed. So as a result, a lot of the trading volumes that were there in agricultural products, for example, basically disappeared overnight and have not recovered. About 60% of the trade from 2019 did not recover at the end of 2020. And then the firms, as a result, that are hit the hardest are the exporting firms and the firms in the sectors like transport and retail trade that rely a lot on direct customer interaction.
On the other end of the scale, which firms have been the most resilient through all of this?
What we've seen over the last 6 to 9 months is actually a resurgence of state-owned companies. The government has used state-owned companies and enterprises, larger companies, to also de facto serve as local safety nets for their employees, but also for the larger communities in which they operate. And these companies have been given extra financial resources by governments, fiscal resources, so they are doing relatively better. But as I said, a lot more is expected from them in terms of de facto social safety net.
Talking of the social safety net, what do we know about the impact on households in Africa of COVID-19?
Well, we know from several chapters in our book, Tim, that the initial impact was rapid reduction in food consumption by about 30% or so across the board, both in urban and in rural areas. And these are countries where already food shortages have been an issue. So it has a direct impact on the livelihood of many households. And this was coupled in a number of countries with essentially the governments sending people from the urban areas, where many of them worked perhaps informally, back to villages and to rural areas so that they don't spread the virus in the cities, which also has had an effect on living conditions and wages. The precise effect, we don't know yet, but we know it's quite substantial because these were the wage earners for many families in Africa.
Ugo, last year we spoke about debt in regards to Africa. There have been warnings of a debt tsunami in Africa, and we've already had Zambia defaulting. You were part of a group of economists that was advocating a debt standstill for exactly this reason. Why was that debt standstill not taken up?
Okay, thanks. That's a good question, Tim. So just a little bit of background. Since the pandemic started, about 100 countries applied for IMF assistance. And in March, the president of the World Bank and the MD of the IMF called for a debt standstill. And the G20 followed up quite quickly. In April, the G20 issued a communique supporting a debt service suspension initiative, in which has recently, it was supposed to end at the end of 2020, and now it has been extended until June 2021 and probably will be extended more. Two problems with this initiative, which our plan now get to our plan. First of all, it only focused on the poorest country and not on middle income country, which could also face problem. And the second was that it encouraged the private sector to participate, but you know, it didn't require the private sector to participate. So our proposal that you mentioned, Tim, was providing both stick and carrots for private sector participation. And as you said, you know, it was not very successful. Why was not very successful? Well, essentially for two reasons. One is what I kind of hinted, the private sector resisted to participating. And the second thing is that countries were very much afraid to damaging their reputation in the international capital market by asking for help. So that's a little bit the story. And at the same time, capital flows resumed. So this massive sudden stop didn't last as long as many of us expected. So for the moment, you know, many countries didn't feel the need to apply for such initiative.
But given everything that you've just said there, can we expect more defaults in 2021?
Well, let's hope not, but we should prepare for the worst. You know, as you mentioned, Zambia is already in default.
Mm-hmm.
In January, there were talks that Ethiopia might need to restructure its debt. So this is a very large country. South Africa, who knows what will happen, but, you know, its fiscal situation, it's not in great shape. There are four countries, Angola, Zambia, Ghana, and Gabon, in which interest payments are more than 100% of health expenditure.
Yeah.
So in the book, we have a chapter joined with Patrick Bolton and Mito Gulati, in which we discuss a proposal which we call legal air cover. And we say, you know, let's hope that nothing bad happens. But if something bad happens and many countries default at the same time, let's have something in place which could facilitate restructuring process.
We sort of assume that development banks, multilateral institutions, are the go-to institutions in a crisis like this. Have they been able to make a difference in Africa?
Yes and no. I mean, so we have two chapters on this in the book. One is authored by Raba Areski, who is co-editor of the ebook. Mm. Another one by Justin Sanford and co-authors. And this chapter makes the point that in the past, after World War II, the IFI were the main players. So basically, Europe was partly rebuilt with loans by the World Bank. You know, the high-speed train system in Japan was basically built with loans from the World Bank.
Mm.
So these guys were really the main player. Now the economy has grown a lot. Now these international financial institutions are not as large as they used to be compared to the global economy. So they can play a role. They can definitely scale up their lending. But if they really want to play a role, they need to interact more with the private sector and play a catalytic role in mobilizing private sector resources. So they are playing a role, they will play a role, but not just through their lending, but also through this catalytic role.
And what about China? Huge amount of foreign direct investment. But China's had its own problems in the last year. Has it pulled back its investments in Africa?
So we have two chapters on this, one by Deborah Brottigan and Kevin Acker, which looks more at all type of flows from China into Africa, and then a chapter by Amelia Santos Paolino and colleague at the UN, which focuses on FDI. Both chapters, as you mentioned, Tim, emphasize the importance of China for flows to Africa. China is the second largest source of FDI, and it's also the second largest source after the World Bank of development aid to Africa, and for many countries is the largest source. We don't still have precise data of what's going to happen to Chinese flows to Africa, but a preliminary analysis based on commitment, it seems that the decrease will be substantial. So there was a sharp drop of commitment in the first quarter of 2020.
Simeon, what would really help in Africa would be mass vaccination, wouldn't it? This has been controversial. Many countries fighting over vaccines at the moment. How soon will this happen in Africa? Will it be soon enough?
Not soon enough. Tim Wei's goal to have vaccines for about 20% of the African population. This is an international goal, an international setup to provide these vaccinations. But beyond the goal, there is the question of financing, which in many cases is still outstanding. And then the question of the actual implementation. How do you deliver the vaccines? And many African leaders are becoming more and more concerned that there is international competition, if you like, for who gets the most vaccines, with advanced economies being well ahead. And in the United States, with the new administration, it has become very clear that a lot of the vaccines produced in the US will remain in the US. So we are indeed in the book raising this as a very, very real possibility that Africa will not get the vaccines in 2021 that it has aimed for. And note again, Tim, that 20% is far insufficient with all the caveats that I've described.
And Ugo, looking at advanced economies here, what aspects of the recovery in advanced economies would do the most to help Africa at the moment?
Well, it's a little bit what Simeon said. If there is a recovery in the largest economy, so there is the global economy picks up, many African countries export commodities, so this could have a positive effect in commodities. If tourism resumes, that would be very good for Africa. So in general, if the global economy does well, capital flows might resume. If the global economy does well, Africa should do well, as long as Simeon mentioned, there is the big if of whether there will be enough vaccination to prevent a high number of infections. On the negative side, there is the fact that if economic conditions normalize in advanced economies, and this will lead to tightening of maybe a monetary policy and increase in interest rate, this is unlikely to happen, at least in the short run, if we listen to what the major central bankers are saying. But if this were to happen, then this could have very large negative consequences on the developing world, because it could lead to an increase in the cost of borrowing and retrenchment in capital flows. I don't attach a very high probability to this, but it's something that we should think about.
And finally, Simeon, talking of things that we should think about, I mean, no crisis comes at a good time, but this is particularly badly timed for Africa, considering what progress that many countries in Africa have made on development and creating political economic stability over the last decade. As a result of this crisis, is there a high probability we might be facing a wave of political and social instability in Africa?
Indeed, Tim, we're already seeing in some countries, especially in West Africa, this type of instability, particularly since a lot of the gains that you mentioned, economic, social gains in these African countries were highly concentrated in urban areas, highly concentrated around tourism receipts, trading, which is trading with the rest of the world, Europe, China, precisely the areas that have been hardest hit by COVID, and hence these populations that have benefited a lot over the last decade or so from global trade and global tourism receipts and global investment are now suffering the most. So we see instability rising, and we already see social unrest in a number of African countries. It will be tied to vaccines. Would Africa receive the vaccines that it needs? So far, we are not so positive, but hopefully this changes over the next few months.
Thank you, Simeon.
Thank you.
And Ugo, thank you as well.
Thanks, Tim.
From what you've heard, I'm sure you'll want to download this. It is free. It's open access to you. The ebook is called Shaping Africa's Post-COVID Recovery. And the editors are Raba Arezki, Simeon Jankov, and Ugo Panizza. There is such a wide spread of chapters in this that raises all sorts of issues. There's a lot to read there. This has been a Vox Talk from the Center for Economic Policy Research. We bring you the most innovative economic research every week, so subscribe to Vox Talks, you'll never miss an episode. And remember, you can find more than 12 years of Vox Talks at voxeu.org/vox-talks.